This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Reckoning by John Grisham. Read for you by Michael Beck. Part 1. The Killing. Chapter 1. On a cold morning in early October of 1946, Pete Banning awoke before sunrise and had no thoughts of going back to sleep. For a long time, he lay in the center of his bed, stared at the dark ceiling, and asked himself for the thousandth time if he had the courage. Finally, as the first trace of dawn peeked through a window, he accepted the solemn reality that it was time for the killing. The need for it had become so overwhelming that he could not continue with his daily routines. He could not remain the man he was until the deed was done. Its planning was simple, yet difficult to imagine. Its aftershocks would rattle on for decades and change the lives of those he loved and many of those he didn't. Its notoriety would create a legend, though he certainly wanted no fame. Indeed, as was his nature, he wished to avoid the attention. But that would not be possible. He had no choice. The truth had slowly been revealed, and once he had the full grasp of it, the killing became as inevitable as the sunrise. He dressed slowly, as always, his war-wounded legs stiff and painful from the night, and made his way through the dark house to the kitchen, where he turned on a dim light and brewed his coffee. As it percolated, he stood ramrod straight beside the breakfast table, clasped his hands behind his head, and gently bent both knees. He grimaced as pain radiated from his hips to his ankles, but he held the squat for 10 seconds. He relaxed, did it again and again, each time sinking lower. There were metal rods in his left leg and shrapnel in his right. Pete poured coffee, added milk and sugar, and walked outside onto the back porch, where he stood at the steps and looked across his land. The sun was breaking in the east, and a yellowish light cast itself across the sea of white. The fields were thick and heavy with cotton that looked like fallen snow, and on any other day, Pete would manage a smile at what would certainly be a bumper crop. But there would be no smiles on this day. Only tears, and lots of them. To avoid the killing, though, would be an act of cowardice, a notion unknown to his being. He sipped his coffee and admired his land and was comforted by its security. Below the blanket of white was a layer of rich black topsoil that had been owned by Bannings for over 100 years. Those in power would take him away and would probably execute him, but his land would endure forever and support his family. Mac, his blue tick hound, awoke from his slumber and joined him on the porch. Pete spoke to him and rubbed his head. The cotton was bursting in the bowls and straining to be picked, and before long, teams of field hands would load into wagons for the ride to the far acres. As a boy, Pete rode in the wagon with the Negroes and pulled a cotton sack 12 hours a day. The Bannings were farmers and landowners, but they were workers, not gentrified planters with decadent lives made possible by the sweat of others. He sipped his coffee and watched the fallen snow grow whiter as the sky brightened. In the distance, beyond the cattle barn and the chicken coop, he heard the voices of the Negroes as they were gathering at the tractor shed for another long day. They were men and women he had known his entire life, dirt-poor field hands whose ancestors had toiled the same land for a century. What would happen to them after the killing? Nothing really. They had survived with little and knew nothing else. Tomorrow they would gather in stunned silence at the same time, in the same place, and whisper over the fire, then head to the fields, worried no doubt, but also eager to pursue their labors and collect their wages. The harvest would go on, undisturbed and abundant. He finished his coffee, placed the cup on a porch rail, and lit a cigarette. He thought of his children. Joel was a senior at Vanderbilt, and Stella was in her second year at Hollins, and he was thankful they were away. He could almost feel their fear and shame at their father being in jail, but he was confident they would survive, like the field hands. They were intelligent and well-adjusted, and they would always have the land. They would finish their education, marry well, and prosper. As he smoked, he picked up his coffee cup, returned to the kitchen, and stepped to the phone to call his sister, Flory. It was a Wednesday, the day they met for breakfast, and he confirmed that he would be there before long. He poured out the dregs, lit another cigarette, and took his barn jacket off a hook by the door. He and Mac walked across the backyard to a trail that led past the garden where Nineveh and Amos grew an abundance of vegetables to feed the Bannings and their dependents. He passed the cattle barn and heard Amos talking to the cows as he prepared to milk them. Pete said good morning, and they discussed a certain fat hog that had been selected for a gutting come Saturday. He walked on, with no limp, though his legs ached. At the tractor shed, the Negroes were gathered around a fire pit as they bantered and sipped coffee from tin cups. When they saw him, they grew silent. Several offered, "Morning, Mr. Bannon," and he spoke to them. The men wore old, dirty overalls, the women, long dresses and straw hats. No one wore shoes. The children and teenagers sat near a wagon, huddled under a blanket, sleepy-eyed and solemn-faced, dreading another long day picking cotton. There was a school for Negroes on the Banning land, one made possible by the generosity of a rich Jew from Chicago, and Pete's father had put up enough in matching funds to see it built. The Bannings insisted that all the colored children on their land study at least through the eighth grade. But in October, when nothing mattered but the picking, the school was closed and the students were in the fields. Pete spoke quietly with Buford, his white foreman. They discussed the weather, the tonnage picked the day before, the price of cotton on the Memphis Exchange. There were never enough pickers during peak season, and Buford was expecting a truckload of white workers from Tupelo. He had expected them the day before, but they did not show. There was a rumor that a farmer 2 miles away was offering a nickel more per pound, but such talk was always rampant during the harvest. Picking crews worked hard one day, disappeared the next, and then came back as prices fluctuated. The Negroes, though, did not have the advantage of shopping around, and the Bannings were known to pay everyone the same. The two John Deere tractors sputtered to life, and the field hands loaded into the wagons. Pete watched them rock and sway as they disappeared deep into the fallen snow. He lit another cigarette and walked with Mac past the shed and along a dirt road. Flory lived a mile away on her section of land, and these days, Pete always went there on foot. The exercise was painful, but the doctors had told him that long walks would eventually fortify his legs, and the pain might one day subside. He doubted that, and had accepted the reality that his legs would burn and ache for the rest of his life, a life he was lucky to have. He had once been presumed dead and had indeed come very close to the end, so every day was a gift. Until now. Today would be the last day of his life as he knew it. And he had accepted this. He had no choice. Florrie lived in a pink cottage she had built after their mother died and left them the land. She was a poet with no interest in farming, but had a keen interest in the income it generated. Her section, 640 acres, was just as fertile as Pete's, and she leased it to him for half the profits. It was a handshake arrangement, one as ironclad as any thick contract, and grounded on implicit trust. When he arrived, she was in the backyard, walking through her aviary of chicken wire and netting, scattering feed as she chatted to her assortment of parrots, parakeets, and toucans. Beside the bird haven was a hutch where she kept a dozen chickens. Her two golden retrievers sat on the grass, watching the feeding with no interest in the exotic birds. Her house was filled with cats, creatures neither Pete nor the dogs cared for. He pointed to a spot on the front porch and told Mac to rest there, then went inside. Marietta was busy in the kitchen, and the house smelled of fried bacon and corn cakes. He said good morning to her and took a seat at the breakfast table. She poured him coffee, and he began reading the Tupelo morning paper. From the old phonograph in the living room, a soprano wailed in operatic misery. He often wondered how many other folks in Ford County listened to opera. When Florrie was finished with her birds, she came in the rear door, said good morning to her brother, and sat across from him. There were no hugs, no affection. To those who knew them, the Bannings were thought to be cold and distant, devoid of warmth and rarely emotional. This was true, but not intentional. They had simply been raised that way. Florrie was 48 and had survived a brief and bad marriage as a young woman. She was one of the few divorced women in the county and thus looked down upon, as if somehow damaged and perhaps immoral. Not that she cared. She didn't. She had a few friends and seldom left her property. Behind her back, she was often referred to as the Bird Lady, and not affectionately. Marietta served them thick omelets with tomatoes and spinach, corn cakes bathed with butter, bacon, and strawberry jam. Except for the coffee, sugar, and salt, everything on the table came from their soil. Florrie said, "I received a letter from Stella yesterday. She seems to be doing fine, though struggling with calculus. She prefers literature and history. She is so much like me." Pete's children were expected to write at least one letter a week to their aunt, who wrote to them at least twice a week. Pete wasn't much for letters and had told them not to bother. However, writing to their aunt was a strict requirement. "Haven't heard from Joel," she said.
"I'm sure he's busy," Pete said, as he flipped a page of the newspaper. "Is he still seeing that girl?"
"I suppose. He's much too young for romance, Pete. You should say something to him."
"He won't listen." Pete took a bite of his omelet. "I just want him to hurry up and graduate. I'm tired of paying tuition."
"I suppose the picking is going well," she said. She had hardly touched her food.
"Could be better, and the price dropped again yesterday. There's too much cotton this year."
"The price goes up and down, doesn't it? When the price is high, there's not enough cotton, and when it's low, there's too much of it. Damned if you do, damned if you don't."
"I suppose."
He toyed with the idea of warning his sister of what was to come. But she would react badly, beg him not to do it, become hysterical, and they would fight, something they had not done in years. The killing would change her life dramatically. And on the one hand, he pitied her and felt an obligation to explain. But on the other, he knew that it could not be explained, and attempting to do so would serve no useful purpose. The thought that this could be their last meal together was difficult to comprehend. But then, most things that morning were being done for the last time. They were obliged to discuss the weather, and this went on for a few minutes. According to the almanac, the next 2 weeks would be cool and dry, perfect for picking. Pete offered the same concerns about the lack of field hands, and she reminded him that this complaint was common every season. Indeed, last week, over omelets, he had lamented the shortage of temporary workers. Pete was not one to linger over food, especially on this awful day. He had been starved during the war and knew how little the body needed to survive. A thin frame kept weight off his legs. He chewed a bite of bacon, sipped his coffee, turned another page, and listened as Flory went on about a cousin who had just died at 90. Too soon, in her opinion. Death was on his mind, and he wondered what the Tupelo paper would say about him in the days to come. There would be stories, and perhaps a lot of them, but he had no desire to attract attention. It was inevitable, though, and he feared the sensational.
"You're not eating much," she said, "and you're looking a bit thin."
"Not much of an appetite," he replied.
"How much are you smoking?"
"As much as I want." He was 43, and at least in her opinion, looked older. His thick, dark hair was graying above his ears, and long wrinkles were forming across his forehead. The dashing young soldier who had gone off to war was aging too fast. His memories and burdens were heavy, but he kept them to himself. The horrors he had survived would never be discussed, not by him anyway. Once a month, he forced himself to ask about her writing, her poetry. A few pieces had been published in obscure literary magazines in the last decade, but not much. In spite of her lack of success, she loved nothing more than to bore her brother, his children, and her small circle of friends with the latest developments in her career. She could prattle on forever about her projects or about certain editors who loved her poetry but just couldn't seem to find room for it, or fan letters she had received from around the world. Her following was not that wide. And Pete suspected the lone letter from some lost soul in New Zealand 3 years earlier was still the only one that arrived with a foreign stamp. He didn't read poetry, and after being forced to read his sister's, he had sworn off the stuff forever. He preferred fiction, especially from Southern writers, and especially William Faulkner, a man he had met before the war at a cocktail party in Oxford. This morning was not the time to discuss it. He was facing an ugly chore, a monstrous deed, one that could not be avoided or postponed any longer. He shoved his plate away, his food half eaten, and finished his coffee. "Always a pleasure," he said with a smile as he stood. He thanked Marietta, put on his barn coat, and left the cottage. Mac was waiting on the front steps. From the porch, Flory called goodbye to him as he walked away and waved without turning around. Back on the dirt road, he lengthened his stride and shook off the stiffness caused by half an hour of sitting. The sun was up and burning off the dew, and all around the thick boles sagged on the stems and begged to be picked. He walked on, a lonely man whose days were numbered. Nineveh was in the kitchen at the gas stove stewing the last tomatoes for canning. He said good morning, poured fresh coffee, and took it to his study, where he sat at his desk and arranged his papers. All bills were paid. All accounts were current and in order. The bank statements were reconciled and showed sufficient cash on hand. He wrote a one-page letter to his wife, addressed and stamped the envelope. He placed a checkbook and some files in a briefcase and left it beside his desk. From a bottom drawer, he withdrew his Colt 45 revolver, checked to make sure all six chambers were loaded, and stuck it in the pocket of his barn jacket. At 8 o'clock, he told Nineveh he was going to town and asked if she needed anything. She did not, and he left the front porch with Mac behind him. He opened the door to his new 1946 Ford pickup, and Mac jumped onto the passenger side of the bench seat. Mac rarely missed a ride to town, and today would be no different, at least for the dog. The Banning home, a splendid colonial revival built by Pete's parents before the crash in 1929, sat on Highway 18, south of Clanton. The county road had been paved the year before with post-war federal money. The locals believed that Pete had used his clout to secure the funding, but it wasn't true. Clanton was 4 miles away, and Pete drove slowly, as always. There was no traffic, except for an occasional mule-drawn trailer laden with cotton and headed for the gin. A few of the county's larger farmers, like Pete, owned tractors, but most of the hauling was still done by mules, as were the plowing and planting. All picking was by hand. The John Deere and International Harvester corporations were trying to perfect mechanized pickers that would supposedly one day eliminate the need for so much manual labor. But Pete had his doubts. Not that it mattered. Nothing mattered but the task at hand. Cotton, blown from the trailers, littered the shoulders of the highway. Two sleepy-eyed colored boys loitered by a field road and waved as they admired his truck, one of two new Fords in the county. Pete did not acknowledge them. He lit a cigarette and said something to Mac as they entered the town. Near the courthouse square, he parked in front of the post office and watched the foot traffic come and go. He wished to avoid people he knew, or those who might know him, because after the killing, any witnesses were apt to offer such banal observations as, "I saw him and he seemed perfectly normal." While the next one might say, "Bumped into him at the post office and he had a deranged look about him." After a tragedy, those with even the slightest connections to it often exaggerate their involvement and importance. He eased from his truck, walked to the letterbox, and mailed the envelope to his wife. Driving away, he circled the courthouse with its wide shaded lawn and gazebos and had a vague image of what a spectacle his trial might be. Would they haul him in with handcuffs? Would the jury show sympathy? Would his lawyers work some magic and save him? Too many questions with no answers. He passed the tea shop, where the lawyers and bankers held forth each morning over scalding coffee and buttermilk biscuits, and wondered what they would say about the killing. He avoided the coffee shop because he was a farmer and had no time for the idle chit-chat. Let them talk. He expected little sympathy from them or from anyone else in the county, for that matter. He cared nothing for sympathy, sought no understanding, had no plans to explain his actions. At the moment, he was a soldier with orders and a mission to carry out. He parked on a quiet street a block behind the Methodist church. He got out, stretched his legs for a moment, zipped up his barn jacket, told Mac that he would return shortly, and began walking toward the church his grandfather had helped build 70 years earlier. It was a short walk, and along the way he saw no one. Later, no one would claim to have seen him. The Reverend Dexter Bell had been preaching at the Clanton Methodist Church since 3 months before Pearl Harbor. It was the third church of his ministry, and he would have been rotated onward like all Methodist preachers but for the war. Shortages in the ranks had caused a shifting of duties, an upsetting of schedules. Normally, in the Methodist denomination, a minister lasted only 2 years in one church, sometimes three, before being reassigned. Reverend Bell had been in Clanton for 5 years and knew it was only a matter of time before he was called to move on. Unfortunately, the call did not arrive in time. He was sitting at his desk in his office, in an annex behind the handsome sanctuary, alone as usual on Wednesday morning. The church secretary worked only 3 afternoons each week. The Reverend had finished his morning prayers, had his study Bible open on his desk along with 2 reference books, and was contemplating his next sermon when someone knocked on his door. Before he could answer, the door swung open, and Pete Banning walked in, frowning and filled with purpose. Surprised at the intrusion, Bell said,
"Well, good morning, Pete."
He was about to stand when Pete whipped out a pistol with a long barrel and said,
"You know why I'm here."
Bell froze and gawked in horror at the weapon and barely managed to say,
"Pete, what are you doing?"
"I've killed a lot of men, preacher. All brave soldiers on the field. You're the first coward."
"Pete, no, no!"
Dexter said, raising his hands and falling back into his chair, eyes wide and mouth open.
"If it's about Liza, I can explain. No, Pete!"
Pete took a step closer, aimed down at Dexter, and squeezed the trigger. He had been trained as a marksman with all firearms and had used them in battle to kill more men than he cared to remember. And he had spent his life in the woods hunting animals large and small. The first shot went through Dexter's heart, as did the second. The third entered his skull, just above the nose. Within the walls of a small office, the shots boomed like cannon fire, but only 2 people heard them. Dexter's wife, Jackie, was alone in the parsonage on the other side of the church, cleaning the kitchen, when she heard the noise. She later described it as the muffled sounds of someone clapping hands 3 times, and at the moment had no idea it was gunfire. She couldn't possibly have known her husband had just been murdered. Hop Perdue had been cleaning the church for 20 years. He was in the annex when he heard the shots that seemed to shake the building. He was standing in the hallway outside the pastor's study when the door opened and Pete walked out, still holding the pistol. He raised it, aimed it at Hop's face, and seemed ready to fire. Hop fell to his knees and pleaded,
"Please, Mr. Bannon, I ain't done nothing. I got kids, Mr. Bannon."
Pete lowered the gun and said,
"You're a good man, Hop. Go tell the sheriff."
Chapter 2. Standing in the side door, Hop watched Pete walk away, calmly putting the pistol in his jacket pocket as he went. When he was out of sight, Hop shuffled, his right leg was 2 inches shorter than his left, back to the study, eased through the open door, and studied the preacher. His eyes were closed, and his head was slumped to one side, with blood dripping down his nose. Behind his head, there was a mess of blood and matter spattered on the back of his chair. His white shirt was turning red around his chest, and his chest was not moving. Hop stood there for a few seconds, maybe a minute, maybe longer, to make sure there was no movement. He realized there was nothing he could do to help him. The pungent odor of gunpowder hung heavy in the room, and Hop thought he might vomit. Because he was the nearest Negro, he figured he would get blamed for something. Stricken with fear and afraid to move, he touched nothing and managed to slowly back out of the room. He closed the door and began sobbing. Preacher Bell was a gentleman who had treated him with respect and shown concern for his family. A fine man, a family man, a loving man who was adored by his church. Whatever he had done to offend Mr. Pete Banning was certainly not worth his life. It occurred to Hop that someone else might have heard the gunshots. What if Mrs. Bell came running and saw her husband bloodied and dead at his desk? Hop waited and waited and tried to compose himself. He knew he didn't have the courage to go find her and break the news. Let the white folks do that. There was no one else in the church, and as the minutes passed, he began to realize that the situation was in his hands. But not for long. If someone saw him running from the church, he would undoubtedly become the first suspect. So he left the annex as calmly as possible and hurried down the same street Mr. Banning had taken. He picked up his pace, bypassed the square, and before long saw the jail. Deputy Roy Lester was getting out of a patrol car. "Morning, Hop," he said. Then noticed his red eyes and the tears on his cheeks.
"Preacher Bell's been shot," Hop blurted. "He dead."
With Hop in the front seat and still wiping tears, Lester sped through the quiet streets of Clanton and minutes later slid to a dusty stop in the gravel parking lot outside the annex. In front of them, the door flew open and Jackie Bell ran through it, screaming. Her hands were red with blood. Her cotton dress was stained as well, and she had touched and streaked her face. She was howling, screaming, saying nothing they could understand, just shrieking in horror. Her face contorted in shock. Lester grabbed her, tried to restrain her, but she tore away and yelled,
"He's dead! He's dead! Somebody kill my husband!"
Lester grabbed her again, tried to console her and keep her from returning to the study. Hop watched and had no idea what to do. He was still worried that he might get blamed and wanted to limit his involvement. Mrs. Van Landingham, from across the street, heard the commotion and came running, still holding a dish towel. She arrived just as the sheriff, Nix Gridley, wheeled into the parking lot and slid in the gravel. Nick scrambled out of his car, and when Jackie saw him, she screamed,
"He's dead, Nix! Dexter's dead! Somebody shot him! Oh my God! Help me!"
Nix, Lester, and Mrs. Van Landingham walked her across the street and onto the porch, where she fell into a wicker rocker. Mrs. Van Landingham tried to wipe her face and hands, but Jackie shoved her away. She buried her face in her hands, sobbing painfully, while groaning, almost retching. Nick said to Lester,
"Stay with her."
He crossed the street, where Deputy Red Arnett was waiting. They entered the annex and slowly crept into the study, where they found Preacher Bell's body on the floor beside his chair. Nick carefully touched his right wrist and after a few seconds said,
"There's no pulse."
"No surprise there,"
Arnett said.
Don't reckon we need an ambulance.
I'd say no. Call the funeral home.
Hop stepped into the study and said,
Mr. Pete Bannon shot him. Heard him do it. Saw the gun.
Nick stood, frowned at Hop, and said,
Pete Bannon?
Yes, sir. I was out there in the hall. He pointed the gun at me, then told me to go find you.
What else did he say?
Said I was a good man. That's all. Then he left.
Nix folded his arms across his chest and looked at Red, who shook his head in disbelief and mumbled,
Pete Bannon?
Both looked at Hop as if they didn't believe him. Hop said,
That's right. Seen him myself with a long barrel revolver. Aimed it right here,
he said, pointing to a spot in the center of his forehead.
Thought I was dead, too.
Nix pushed his hat back and rubbed his cheeks. He looked at the floor and noticed the pool of blood spreading and moving silently away from the body. He looked at Dexter's closed eyes and asked himself for the first time, and the first of many, what could have possibly provoked this?
Red said, Well, I guess this crime is solved.
I suppose it is, Nick said. But let's take some pictures and look for slugs.
What about the family?
Red asked. Same thought here. Let's get Miss Bell back in the parsonage and get some ladies to sit with her. I'll go to the school and talk to the principal. They have 3 kids, right?
I think so.
That's right, Hop said. 2 girls and a boy.
Nix looked at Hop and said,
Not a word out of you, Hop, okay? I mean it, not a word. Don't tell a soul what happened here. If you talk, I swear I'll throw you in jail.
No, sir, Mr. Sheriff. I ain't saying nothing.
They left the study, closed the door, and walked outside. Across the street, more neighbors were gathering around the Van Landingham porch. Most were housewives, standing on the lawn, wide-eyed with their hands over their mouths in disbelief. Ford County had not seen a white murder in over 10 years. In 1936, a couple of sharecroppers went to war over a strip of worthless farmland. The one with the better aim prevailed, claimed self-defense at trial, and walked home. 2 years later, a black boy was lynched near the settlement of Box Hill, where he allegedly said something fresh to a white woman. In 1938, though, lynching was not considered murder or a crime of any sort anywhere in the South, especially Mississippi. However, a wrong word to a white woman could be punishable by death. At that moment, neither Nix Gridley, nor Red Arnett, nor Roy Lester, nor anyone else under the age of 70 in Clanton could remember the murder of such a prominent citizen. And the fact that the prime suspect was even more prominent stopped the entire town cold in its tracks. In the courthouse, the clerks and lawyers and judges forgot their business, repeated what they had just heard, and shook their heads. In the shops and offices around the square, the secretaries and owners and customers passed along the stunning news and looked at each other in shock. In the schools, the teachers quit teaching, left their students, and huddled in the hallways. On the shaded streets around the square, neighbors stood near mailboxes and worked hard to think of different ways to say, "This can't be true." But it was. A crowd gathered in the Van Landingham yard and gazed desperately across the street at the gravel lot, where 3 patrol cars, the county's entire fleet, along with the hearse from McGargle's funeral home, were parked. Jackie Bell had been escorted back to the parsonage, where she was sitting with a doctor friend and some ladies from the church. Soon the streets were crowded with cars and trucks driven by the curious. Some inched along, their drivers gawking. Others parked haphazardly, as close to the church as possible. The presence of the hearse was a magnet, and the people moved onto the parking lot, where Roy Lester told them to stand back. The rear door of the hearse was partially open, which meant, of course, that a body would soon be brought to it and loaded for the short drive to the funeral home. As with any tragedy, crime, or accident, what the curious really wanted was to see a body. Stunned and shocked as they were, they inched forward in muted silence and realized they were the lucky ones. They were witnesses to a dramatic piece of an unimaginable story, and for the rest of their lives, they could talk of being there when Preacher Bell was taken away in a hearse. Sheriff Gridley walked through the annex door, glanced at the crowd, and removed his hat. Behind him, the stretcher appeared, with Old Man McGargle holding one end and his son the other. The corpse was covered with a black drape, and only Dexter's brown shoes were visible. All the men instantly removed their hats and caps, and all the women bowed their heads, but they did not close their eyes. Some were sobbing quietly. When the body was properly loaded and the rear door was closed, Old Man McGargle got behind the wheel and drove away. Never one to miss the opportunity for some extra drama, he poked through the side streets until he entered the square, then did two slow laps around the courthouse so the town could have a look. An hour later, Sheriff Gridley called with instructions to transport the body to Jackson for an autopsy. Nineveh could not remember the last time Mr. Pete had asked her to sit with him on the front porch. She had better things to do. Amos was in the barn churning butter and needed her help. After that, she had a mess of peas and beans to can. There was some dirty laundry to wash. But if the boss said sit there in that rocker and let's visit for a spell, then she could not argue. She sipped iced tea while he smoked cigarettes, more than usual, she would recall later when she told Amos. He seemed preoccupied with the traffic out on the highway, a quarter of a mile down the drive. A few cars and trucks inched along, passing trailers filled with cotton, and headed to the gin in town. When the sheriff's car made its turn, Pete said, "There he comes."
"Who?"
she asked.
"Sheriff Gridley."
"What he want?"
"He's coming to arrest me, Nineveh, for murder. I just shot and killed Dexter Bell, the Methodist preacher."
"Get out of here! You done what?"
"You heard me."
He stood and walked a few steps to where she was sitting. He leaned down and pointed a finger at her face.
"And you will never say a word to anyone, Nineveh. You hear me?"
Her eyes were as big as eggs, and her mouth was wide open, but she could not speak. He pulled a small envelope out of his coat pocket and handed it to her.
"Get in the house now, and as soon as I leave, take this to Florrie."
He took her hand, helped her to her feet, and opened the screen door. When she was inside, she let loose with a painful howl that startled him. He closed the front door and turned to watch the sheriff approach. Gridley was in no hurry. He stopped and parked by Pete's truck, got out of his patrol car with Red and Roy for support, and walked toward the porch before stopping at the steps. He stared at Pete, who seemed unconcerned.
"Better come with us, Pete," Nick said.
Pete pointed to his truck and said,
"The pistol is on the front seat."
Nix looked at Red and said,
"Get it."
Pete slowly stepped down and walked to the sheriff's car. Roy opened a rear door. and as Pete was bending over, he heard Nineveh wail in the backyard. He looked up and saw her scampering toward the barn, holding the letter.
"Let's go," Nick said, as he opened his door and situated himself behind the wheel.
Red sat next to him and held the gun. In the rear seat, Roy and Pete were side by side, their shoulders almost touching. No one said a word. Indeed, no one seemed to breathe as they left the farm and turned onto the highway. The lawmen were going through the motions with a sense of disbelief, shocked like everyone else. A popular preacher murdered in cold blood by the town's favorite son, a legendary war hero. There had to be a damn good reason for it, and it was only a matter of time before the truth spilled out. But at that moment, the clock had stopped, and events were not real. Halfway to town, Nix glanced in his mirror and said,
"I'm not going to ask why you did it, Pete. Just want to confirm it was you. That's all."
Pete took a deep breath and looked at the cotton fields they were passing and said,
"I have nothing to say."
The Ford County Jail had been built in a prior century and was barely fit for human habitation. Originally a small warehouse, it had been converted to this and to that, and finally bought by the county and divided in two by a brick wall. In the front half, six cells were configured to hold the white prisoners, and in the back, eight cells were squeezed in for the blacks. The jail was rarely filled to capacity, at least up front. Attached to it was a small office wing the county had later built for the sheriff and the Clanton Police Department. The jail was only two blocks off the square, and from its front door one could see the top of the courthouse. During criminal trials, which were rare, the accused was often walked from the jail with a deputy or two as escorts. A crowd had gathered in front of the jail to get a glimpse of the killer. It was still inconceivable that Pete Banning did what he did, and there was also a general disbelief that he would be thrown in jail. Surely, for someone as prominent as Mr. Banning, there would be another set of rules. However, if Nix indeed had the guts to arrest him, there were enough curious folks who wanted to see it for themselves.
"I guess word's out," Nix mumbled as he turned into the small gravel lot by the jail. "Not a word by anybody," he instructed.
The car stopped and all four doors opened. Nix grabbed Banning by the elbow and ushered him to the front door, with Red and Roy following. The crowd, gawking, was still and silent until a reporter with the Ford County Times stepped forward with a camera and snapped a photo with a flash that startled even Pete. Just as he was entering the door, someone yelled,
"You'll die in hell, Banning!"
That's right," someone else added.
The suspect didn't flinch and seemed oblivious to the crowd. Soon he was inside and out of sight. Waiting inside, in a cramped room where all suspects and criminals were signed in and processed, was Mr. John Wilbanks, a prominent lawyer in town and longtime friend of the Bannings.
"And to what do we owe this pleasure?"
Nick said to Mr. Wilbanks, obviously not pleased to see him.
"Mr. Banning is my client, and I'm here to represent him,"
Wilbanks replied. He stepped forward and shook hands with Pete without a word. Nick said,
"We'll do our business first, then you can do yours."
Wilbanks said, "I've already called Judge Oswalt, and we've discussed bail."
"Wonderful. When you've discussed it to the point of him granting bail, I'm sure he'll give me a call. Until then, Mr. Wilbanks, this man is a suspect in a murder, and I'll deal with him accordingly. Now, would you please leave?"
I would like to speak with my client. He's not going anywhere. Come back in an hour.
No interrogation. You understand?
Banning said, I have nothing to say. Flory read the note on her front porch as Nineveh and Amos watched. They were still panting from their sprint from the main house and horrified at what was happening. When she finished, she lowered it, looked at them, and asked,
And he's gone? The law took him, Miss Flory, Nineveh said. He knew they were coming to get him. Did he say anything? He said he done killed the preacher,
Nineveh replied, wiping her cheeks. The note instructed Flory to call Joel at Vanderbilt and Stella at Holland's and explain to them that their father had been arrested for the murder of the Reverend Dexter Bell. They were to speak to no one about this, especially reporters, and they were to stay away at college until further notice. He was sorry for this tragic turn of events, but hopeful that one day they would understand. He asked Flory to visit him the following day at the jail to discuss matters. She felt faint, but could show no weakness in front of the help. She folded the note, stuck it in a pocket, and dismissed them. Nineveh and Amos backed away, more frightened and confused than before, and slowly walked across her front yard to the trail. She watched them until they were out of sight, then sat in a wicker rocker with one of her cats and fought her emotions. He had certainly seemed preoccupied at breakfast only a few hours earlier, but then he had not been right since the war. Why hadn't he warned her? How could he do something so unbelievably evil? What would happen to him, his children, his wife, to her, his only sibling, and the land? Flory was far from a devout Methodist, but she had been raised in the church and attended occasionally. She had learned to keep her distance from the ministers because they were gone by the time they'd settled in. But Bell was one of the better ones. She thought of his pretty wife and children and finally broke down. Marietta eased through the screen door and stood beside her as she sobbed. Chapter 3. The town descended upon the Methodist Church. As the crowd grew, a deacon told Hop to unlock the sanctuary. The stricken mourners filed in and filled the pews and whispered the latest, whatever that happened to be. They prayed and wept and wiped their faces and shook their heads in disbelief. The faithful members, those who knew Dexter well and loved him dearly, clung together in small groups and moaned in their suffering. For the less committed, those who attended monthly but not weekly, the church was a magnet that drew them as close as possible to the tragedy. Even some of the truly backslidden arrived to share in the suffering. At that awful moment, everyone was a Methodist and welcomed in Reverend Bell's church. The murder of their preacher was emotionally and physically overwhelming. The fact that he had been killed by one of their own was, initially, too astonishing to believe. Joshua Banning, Pete's grandfather, had helped build the church. His father had been a deacon his entire adult life. Most of those present had sat in those same pews and offered countless prayers for Pete during the war. They had been devastated when the news arrived from the War Department that he was presumed dead. They had held candlelight vigils at his second coming. They had rejoiced in tears when he and Liza made their grand re-entry the week after the Japanese surrendered. Every Sunday morning during the war, Reverend Bell had called out the names of the soldiers from Ford County and offered a special prayer. First on his list was Pete Banning, the town's hero and the source of immense local pride. Now the rumor that he had murdered their preacher was simply too incredible to absorb. But as the news sank in, the whispering intensified, in some circles anyway, and the great question of why was asked 1,000 times. Only a few of the bravest dared to suggest that Pete's wife had something to do with it. What the mourners really wanted was to get their hands on Jackie and the children, to touch them and have a good cry, as if that would soften their shock. But Jackie, according to the gossip, was next door in the parsonage, secluded in her bedroom with her 3 children and seeing no one. The house was packed with her closest friends, and the crowd spilled out onto the porches and across the front yard, where grim-faced men smoked and grumbled. When friends stepped outside for fresh air, others stepped inside to take their places. Still others moved next door to the sanctuary. The stricken and the curious continued to come, and the streets around the church were lined with cars and trucks. Folks drifted toward the church in small groups, moving slowly as if they weren't sure what they would do when they got there, but were needed nonetheless. When the pews were packed, Hop opened the door to the balcony. He hid in the shadows below the belfry and avoided everyone. Sheriff Gridley had threatened him, and he was saying nothing. He did marvel, though, at the way the white folks managed to keep their composure, most of them anyway. The slaying of a popular black preacher would provoke an outpouring far more chaotic. A deacon suggested to Miss Emma Fay Riddle that some music might be appropriate. She had played the organ for decades, but wasn't sure if the occasion was right. She soon agreed, though, and when she hit the first notes of the old rugged cross, the weeping intensified. Outside under the trees, a man approached a group of smokers and announced,
"They got Pete Bannon in jail. Got his gun, too."
This was met with acceptance, commented on, then passed along until the news entered the sanctuary, where it spread from pew to pew. Pete Banning, arrested for the murder of their preacher. When it became obvious that the suspect indeed had nothing to say, Sheriff Gridley led him through a door and into a narrow hallway with little light. Iron bars lined both sides. There were 3 cells on the right, 3 on the left, each about the size of a walk-in closet. There were no windows, and the jail felt like a damp, dark dungeon, a place where men were forgotten and time went unnoticed, and evidently a place where everyone smoked. Gridley stuck a large key into a door, pulled it open, and nodded for the suspect to step inside. A cheap cot was at the far wall, and there was nothing else in the way of furnishings. Gridley said,
"Not much room, I'm afraid, Pete. But then it is a jail, after all."
Pete stepped inside, glanced around, and said,
"I've seen worse."
He stepped to the cot and sat on it.
"Bathroom's down the hall," Gridley said. "If you need to use it, just yell."
Pete was staring at the floor. He shrugged, said nothing. Gridley slammed the door and returned to his office. Pete stretched out and consumed the full length of his cot. He was 2 inches over 6 feet. The cot was not quite that long. The cell was musty and cold, and he picked up a folded blanket, one that was practically threadbare and would be of little use at night. He didn't care. Captivity was nothing new, and he had survived conditions that now, 4 years later, were still hard to imagine. When John Wilbanks returned less than an hour later, he and the sheriff argued briefly over where exactly the attorney-client conference would take place. There was no designated room for such important meetings. The lawyers usually walked